So, hey, you're listening to another episode of the Sideshow Garden podcast. It's Peter. I'm back again. I know. I say I'm back again, but I've got Maddie Harland still on the end of the line. If you're in iTunes or Spotify, press pause here. Go back not last week or not last episode, but the one before that. You get Maddie part one and then come back here and this will automatically play on for you. Okay. You're back. That's great. This is Maddie Harland. She's the co-founder and editor of Permaculture Magazine. Enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
So that science has been reported by an institute of horticulture and a university in France, so it's peer-reviewed science. So there is a serious side to this, but it's very difficult to communicate in 30 minutes chatting about compost and cycling resources and so forth. But the serious side of permaculture is it is about reducing our environmental impact on this planet. And we know that this has to happen. You know, it's no longer out for discussion that climate change is some kind of theory that not everyone is subscribing to. The science is there. We know our climate's changing. We know it's caused by greenhouse gases. We know we've got to change the way we live. And I can talk in a very light way about the benefits of saving money, growing gorgeous veg, having an organic system that's reasonably energy efficient and is less intense in terms of labour than other systems that I've used because I've been growing veg and plants all my life. So we can talk about it from that aspect, but the serious aspect is when we start looking at the bigger systems of agroecology, and we know that these can outperform, out yield and be the most ecological ways of growing food on the planet and in any climate as well. And that's where the recommendations are coming from, you know, UN food organizations and others, because the science is appearing that this works.
First of all, for those of you who are serious on your permaculture, I apologize if it in any way came across as superficial, and it is something that I do take quite serious. However, I do have to also put it in a nutshell and say, well, look, if you haven't, how do I say this? If you're standing on the weighbridge and you haven't got a book to hand and you are new to this, I think when I reference the analogy of my 8-year-old daughter on how to be a good person, of all of the things you said, Maddie, it appears to me that if I don't take the plastic bags from the supermarket, if I plant a little bit more responsibly, if I use edibles, for example, a gooseberry bush, to put it in simple terms, underplanted with something like osteospermum, then I'm not using mulch, then I'm not using excesses of water. But there is a, you don't need to ask your elder statesman, be that somebody who's longer in permaculture, a good thing or a bad thing. There's almost like an inert, I know this is right because I'm using less water. I know this is right because it's a little bit more local, that it hasn't been flown in, that I'm not having to drive to the supermarket. And as I always describe my apple trees, they're like that mate that you never invite to the party and he just arrives every year with loads of presents for you. I think they're absolutely wonderful.
Absolutely fantastic, and you can make cider.
Any talk I've ever given on growing your own or biodiversity or, in fact, permaculture, what I've always said is, look, the cheater's guide to growing your own. The one thing that makes Peter Donegan look like an absolute genius is that I have 40 fruit trees. I'm not a full-time farmer.
Well, I wouldn't be irate with you if you were growing azaleas. I mean, it's up to you what you grow. I mean, gardeners, all gardeners have to do what they want to do, you know, and enjoy what they want to enjoy. All that permaculture does is it gives people a framework. So you're a professional horticulturist. You've studied horticultural principles. You've been taught all these things. if you are someone that doesn't have that training, permaculture is a very useful framework, not only for the garden, but for making your life more creative and greener. And, you know, things like one of the principles you mentioned, which is use edges and value the marginal. You will know that the most fertile parts of our planet are those edges, the estuaries where salt water meets fresh water, meets the air and the edges of the land. I mean, that's the most wonderful example of where you get the maximum biodiversity of species, because the fish come in to feed, the birds feed, there's rich life in the mud, all the creatures in the mud, and in, you know, the whole system is changing all the time. But we know that it's the sunny edges of a garden that can be the most fertile and the most able to grow. And it's just learning how to see a landscape and read it in those terms that makes permaculture a useful tool for designing systems. But it's not the meaning of life. It's not the only intelligent thing in the world. It's one system that gets people to think, connect more deeply with natural principles, and live their lives in a more creative and fruitful way. So that's really what I'd say. When it starts to be like it's not a religion, it's not a belief system, it's a toolkit, and it's useful. But it's not the only one.
Maddie, you wrote a book.
I wrote a book called Fertile Edges, Regenerating Land, Culture and Hope. And in some parts, it's like a history of permaculture, where it came from, all the different ways it's evolved all over the world. It's stories of projects that have, you know, from different countries of the world that I've encountered, and stories of people. It's also observations of the things that have happened in the last 20-odd years, the opportunities that we've had to put our planet on a, you know, our societies on a positive track change, the opportunities that we really haven't taken and why. So it's about the possibilities of creating a better world and the times where we've utterly failed to. But it's also stories of where people, individuals and groups of people who've done fantastic regenerative and positive work in many different countries. So and it's also some personal stuff about my own journey and my own connection with the natural world. So it is fundamentally a very positive book, and it's like a roadmap to how we could change, how we could pull back this destruction that we're wreaking on this planet.
Maddie, within that book, you mentioned it there about some of the stories that, can I call it, caught your eye from around the world.
Yeah.
Give me one of the, I guess, the more unique ones. If you were in a pub with me having a pint of Guinness, which I'm told by Matthew Appleby Guinness is actually vegan.
Yes, I'd heard that.
Yes.
I've driven past the Guinness factory in Dublin too.
Well, I didn't just drive past it, Maddie.
I'll have to pop in next time.
Well, you should. I'll go with you just to make sure you don't, you know, the door opens properly and you get in okay. But give me one of those stories, Maddie, if you can.
So in Portugal, in the Iberian Peninsula, there's a project which is called Tamira, and it's a community, and basically they got a lot of rain in the winter, but they were just watching that rain fall and then wash their topsoil down ultimately into the Bay of Biscay. And that's a story of, you know, a problem that Portugal's had as it's become more economically challenged. There's been a greater intensity of sheep grazing, which is damaged the soil, and a lot of the cork oaks have been dying in that area. And cork oaks are a habitat for Iberian lynx and Lee's eagle, which is a beautiful bird that's very, very rare now. And what they did was they decided they'd dam their valley. So they dammed their valley and they made a little sort of mosaic of small lakes to catch the winter rain. And then they put natural clay dams into the valley with, you know, buns, earth buns, and dammed it at critical points so that as the rain fell in the winter, they'd slowly over years fill up these small lakes. And then they started planting around the lakes. And what they noticed, and they planted fruit trees and raised beds, veggie beds and flowers and so forth. And partly for themselves, for their community to eat, and partly as, you know, a yield that they could sell within the local community. They didn't bother to grow citrus because everybody grows citrus in that area. And what they noticed was that the cork oak started to regenerate and they started to grow. Some of the old oaks were just past it, but some of the younger ones near where the landscape was being rehydrated started to grow. They saw that the mist would rise up in the morning and put the dew on the banks and put the moisture into their fruit trees, into their beds, the veggie beds, and into the flowers, and they started to create more and more yields, and they've actually had a Bonelli's eagle come back to that habitat. You know, ducks have come in, they've put fish into the lakes as well, so that they're not just a cause of, you know, mosquitoes, you know, so that there's some kind of ecological balance. And they've just seen that landscape rehydrate from being quite an arid, dry landscape in the summer into something much more temperate, much more beautiful, and much more able to support the community horticulturally. And what inspires me about that story is I know that that hasn't just been done in that place. It's been done in many other places in Europe and beyond, and that there are principles of how we can restore very damaged, degraded landscapes. And they do have similarities to them. You know, they are common sense, and nature works in a certain way, and there is this underlying intelligence that once we have an understanding of it, then we can begin to restore landscapes. And it can happen far more quickly than we imagine, that we can start seeing that regeneration after 2, 3, 4 years. By 10 years, you start to be really talking. And in another project in Africa, they had dried up gullies and they'd lost their watercourses. And within 5 years, the stream started to run again, because they were reforesting the ridges, controlling the grazing so that the trees got an opportunity to get away. And in another project, you said one, but there's so many in India, they've actually changed the climate because of the reforestation that they've done on such a big scale. That inspires me very deeply, because I think when we look at things like climate change and the sixth mass extinction and, you know, ecocide, as we call it, we can feel really depressed about the state of the world. And perhaps we don't always hear in mainstream media the good stories, the stories of that are about healing the earth, about regenerating damaged landscapes, about regrowing community. Because in the African project I mentioned, they did a lot of work around education and leadership, and they had such a success with regenerating the landscape that they were beginning to create really nutritious, good horticultural gardens that were feeding the community and giving the women a little bit of surplus to take to market to generate income. And they found that the whole community's health improved as well, on a significant scale. So, you know, this is one of the ways that we can make this world a better place. And these are simple things, ultimately. You know, they don't need big, vast amounts of money. They don't need big technology. They just need human beings to cooperate and cooperate with nature. And those kind of things make my heart sing, you know, make me smile. And I think we need to hear those stories rather than always hearing the diet of doom and gloom and the sense that, you know, it's too late, because we don't know whether it's too late to turn back the tide to change the climate.
The note that you had there, Maddie, on humans appreciating nature, and to skip a few words forward, making your heart sing. When you said those few words, all I could hear in my head was Marvin Gaye singing in the background, and I was literally on the same page as you. I was about to pour myself a glass of Middleton Very Rare in my head, I say, and only in my head, and sit back and turn the volume up ever so slightly. I have to, because it does make my heart sing, and I was also about to say to you, but I keep getting distracted in my own brain with all of the wonderful things that you're saying to me, Maddie. But we haven't even spoke about this permaculture magazine that you're the editor of.
We only produce 4 a year, but we think 4 good ones is enough. So we've been doing it since 1992, and it is available in shops as well.
If, for example, Maddie, my good friend Tim Howell, bear with me on this one, anti-disestablishmentarianism, in brackets, close brackets, hi Tim. If Tim was to subscribe to your magazine, what, let's say, for example, would he get in, hypothetically, this upcoming autumn issue?
Well, he'd get a mix. He wouldn't just get stuff about gardening. So he might get something about no-dig gardening, how we can protect our seas and reduce plastic in our lives, about Hampton Court Palace and their most fantastic no-dig garden that they have there, something like restorative justice, which is a practice that can help communities deal with conflict. Particularly intergenerational, so that a birthing centre in Africa that also grows their own food, which benefits the health of the babies and the expectant mothers. Maybe some self-build or DIY stuff as well, with the very practical gardening stuff too. And subscribers also get extra content. And we have a digital issues. Any subscriber, whether they're a digital one or whether they like good old-fashioned magazine that they can hold in their hand, get access to our complete archive. So for $14.95, you get 96 magazines, and it's all searchable. So if you've got a particular interest, like eco-building or no-dig or DIY.
One other thing, Maddie, it's not one other thing. It never is one other thing with Peter. It's always one more thing after that one other thing. But you have, I should be promoting Sideshow t-shirts, but I don't make any money on them, so I won't bother my Barney. But your t-shirts on permaculture.co.uk are the bee's knees. The bit I love is that it says that they cost as low as 21 quid, which makes me feel quite good. It doesn't say they'll cost you up to... It's very clever. But I like the fact that they say earth care, people care, future care. They are absolutely splendid. You also do a range of classes and courses.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and there's courses all over the world. And then we're holding a European convergence for permaculture. But if you look at permaculture.co.uk, there's a listing, it's totally free, of all the courses that are running, mainly Ireland and the UK and Europe. But it can lead you to a whole network. Wherever you're hearing the Sod Show, you'll probably find that there is permaculture happening in that country. So you know, it's a great resource and a big starting point for, finding out more, basically.
Yeah, because your website lists everywhere from Devon to Costa Rica to Australia, which
I know,
in a sense, is slightly surprising, but it's not really, I suppose, when you consider that you have, what did we discuss, the director Tim Entwistle of, was it the gardens in Victoria, Australia, where he's head of the Botanic Gardens, my apologies. And in that conversation, I was saying about the Irish weather and, of course, the lots of Irish rain, and that ties in with the essentially the weather in most of the UK anyway. And he was saying, well, we've got the opposite problem, so we're having to adapt, essentially, Botanic Gardens to suit.
Yes, I mean, depending on where we are in the world, obviously differs on what's being taught. But, you know, those basic principles are can be applied and are applied, and everywhere has its own local adaptation. And for me personally, I love going and giving talks and telling those stories that make my heart sing and sharing them with other people, because I think it's important that we tell these stories and create new stories rather than always have the same diet of negativity that I think we are a little bit overshadowed by in our society.
Well, the Sod Show doesn't do negativity. Essentially, it's Peter living in a bubble of sunshine and rainbows, built entirely out of leprechauns, cake, Guinness, and Father's Day socks. Maddie, I've got, genuinely, one final thing before I go, because I always have the school teacher in my head. It was a lecture sermon that I was essentially getting, but schools need to do more for the children. And I said, well, you need to go back to source. So when the schools are being built, what they need to change is the design of the landscape around them, which is four trees, an entire area of car parking and white lines where possible, and some grass, essentially green on top of subsoil with curbing. And we have had some fantastic stories on the Sod Show, in particular one school from West Cork who spoke about how they were essentially growing rice in a dome-shaped, can I call it a greenhouse, and how that one teacher was managing to, I will call it, revolutionise what is as a standard taken as a couple of raised beds within that school car park green, inverted commas, area that has been inherited. I can't change what is existing and what, by planning, people and school teachers are inheriting. Bear with me, folks, at home. I'm getting there. But what I can do is give them maybe five quite simple tips that might be able to help them do something to get them off the ground, if that makes any sense to you, Maddie.
What, the school gardens?
Yeah, assuming that they have nothing existing there.
I think, first of all, you've got to identify who's going to, if you're the teacher, who's going to support you? How do you engage the parents? Because you can't do all these things all on your own, and you've also got the holidays where it's all very well having like a beautiful domed raised bed greenhouse, but who's going to water it while you're on holiday? So create your community support system, engage the kids, make it an outdoor classroom that also is part of how you teach the curriculum. So take your kids, create a classroom, you know, create a garden. Teach them biology in the garden, teach them geography in the garden, teach them physics in the garden. You know, make it a living outdoor classroom, not just a niche gardening place where you know, you only go to grow things. Make it as broad as possible and grow things that are really easy to grow so that the kids get quick wins and they understand that it's actually quite easy to grow plants. So start small and build it up slowly, and have the composting systems and have the flowers and have the container gardens that you've described, Peter, and the things like gooseberries that once you've planted them, they're seriously not that hard to, you know, look after. And start like that and make it a community thing and make it fun.
I'm now off the sideshow bit of my head has been done and dusted, and thank you so much for taking the time, because we ended up as a double episode entirely because I got carried away. I could honestly listen to you read me bedtime stories and just say the word permaculture every random 5 minutes, and I would be perfectly happy with that. You have a wonderful voice and you have a lovely nature about you. That, like when I was growing up, Maddie, in 1980s Cliff Richard tank top, we're all going on a summer holiday and things were a bit beige, including your sandwiches, your potatoes and your trousers. You know, things weren't very Mark Bolan and T-Rex, if you'll allow me put it that way. There was nothing rock and roll about it, and gardening was a little bit path to the back of the garden. Why you'd put a path to the back of the garden, my brain doesn't understand it to this day. And it was blue white, Alisum lobelia, and there's the hedge. Do you think we, a collective of fictitious people, do we not make it sexy enough? Do we need to rock and roll it?
I do.
Yeah?
I think it's got to be fun, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's got to be fun. I mean, when they do the perma blitzes, they make sure it's a whole day, that it's a community event, that people share food, have potluck lunch. You know, it's got to be fun if we're going to garden together. And let's grow some interesting and unusual stuff as well. I mean, one of my favourite trees in my garden is my Nepalese pepper tree. Ooh. And as I pick the peppercorns, it makes me feel slightly euphoric. It's got a gorgeous sort of Himalayan smell to it. And they're great, great in cooking. And I love the Chinese dogwood as well, which is, of course, a beautiful ornamental tree with the most exquisite flowers. But you can eat the fruit as well.
You're kind of halfway into the Mark Diacono level of doing things, if you don't mind me saying, Maddie. He always seems to, everybody else says, I've got the best of the Rolling Stones. And he just scrolls through his album and pulls out, I've got Lou Reed. And you go, wow, this is...
Yeah, he does like his pepper trees, that's for sure.
But again, a bit like talking with you, Maddie, I would sit and I would listen to Mark talking all day. On his episode, we spent about 10 minutes haggling, I should add, and we ended up recording a half an hour because I just got carried away talking with the guy and we just forgot the space of time. But the other thing, Maddie, that I find is that people tend to go out, there's like a Dylan Moran joke in there where they say, okay, I'm going to, get all G'd up and I'm going to dig the garden, and then 2 o'clock comes and they realise my hands are slightly blistered and all of a sudden weeds start to grow out the top off and the timber's covered in grass, and I meant to get around and move that 3 months on and things just go to pot. I like the bit that you said of baby steps and do little but do it extremely well.
Yeah, because there's nothing worse than being over ambitious, doing it badly and then leaving it to go to rot, is there?
No.
I mean, it's a waste of your time. You may as well not garden at all. So start small. Start small. Grow what you like to eat. Grow stuff that's easy for kids to have some early successes with, and get your support system if you're a teacher, so that you're not absolutely holding the whole thing up. Because teachers work pretty hard and they have all that after school preparation and marking and, you know, exam system and so forth. So, you know, if you take on a project out of the goodness of your heart, you need to enjoy it.
For you listening at home, Maddie Harland is the co-founder and editor of Permaculture Magazine. Just send me a note at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesideshow. And thanks for listening on this one, because it was a little bit of, I'll be honest, well, most of them are, aren't they? They're a little bit personal. I kind of get into it a little bit. It's, we'll skip the song 3. I'll go back to song 1. We should have another drink, shouldn't we? Yeah. It gets a little bit like that in my head anyway. And I'm very grateful for you. And I hope you liked this, what has now been a double episode. In the meantime, Maddie Harland, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real genuine pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Peter. And thank you, listeners, as well. Very much appreciated having the opportunity to come on the show.
We'll talk soon, Maddie. I look forward to it.
Thanks. Bye.
We'll have that pint of Guinness is what we'll do. We'll do a detour into James's Gate and we'll get one in there.
Good one.